before we get to our guest today, what I'd like to do is mention that if you would like to get weekly updates concerning the show Media Matters, all you need to do is go to my website, which is pretty simple to remember, robertmcchesney.com, robertmcchesney.com. Go to my website, and you will be able to click on a link that will get you a weekly update sent to you with the topics of our guests every week here on Media Matters. And those guests, they'll give you links to their articles, to their stories, background information on them, everything you'd want to know about our guests. And it'll only get one email a week. You won't get flooded with any commercial emails, there won't be any junk. Anything you want to know about our guests, and keep you posted. If there are late changes in our guests, like this one today, we will do our best to alert you to those late changes. And that's right. So all you have to do is go to robertmcchesney.com, and you can click on this link. And our guest is going to be joining us in a second. We're just hooking up the phone links right now. So we appreciate very much your patience for staying with us during the first couple of minutes today of Media Matters. Again, I'm your host, Robert McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. And also on the show, we should tell you that coming up very soon, we have several other... Oh, I think we have good news for you. We have been able to find Mark Cooper. Mark, are you there? He is on the line, and my producer is working on it right now. And we've got Mark with us, but now we need to somehow just hook him in so that we can get him on the air with us. But he's on the line waiting to hold with us, Mark Cooper. And hello, Mark, are you there?
I am.
Great, Mark. It's wonderful to hear your voice. We thought for a second we weren't going to have you, but I guess...
Yeah, we've got some windstorms here in California, and they're wreaking havoc with the phone lines.
Well, that's not very nice.
No.
But it didn't prevent you from going to Brazil and getting back home safely in the last week. Is that correct?
That's right. Just got back the other day, Bob.
Well, let me, before we go on any further, Mark, let me give a little background on you for our listeners so they can know who exactly we're talking with. Mark Cooper is a contributing editor for The Nation magazine and the host and executive producer of The Nation's syndicated weekly radio show, Radio Nation. He's been a journalist for over 30 years and written for dozens of publications. Early in his career, he worked in the press office of Chilean President Salvador Allende, and he remains a well-respected expert on Latin American affairs. His books include Pinochet and Me, a Chilean anti-memoir, and Rollover Che Guevara, Travels of a Radical Reporter. And I must say before we go on, I hope sometime during the next hour we'll have a chance to talk about Pinochet and Chile today and the Chilean experience. The book, Pinochet and Me, as I've told you personally, Mark, and I tell everyone I talk to, is one of the nicest books, finest books I've read on the subject, and an absolute pleasure to read. I can't give it enough praise, and I urge our listeners, if you're interested in Chilean politics over the past 35 years, Allende, and sort of a sense of the political culture of Latin America, I can't recommend the book strongly enough.
Thank you.
It's absolutely the truth. Well, Mark, let's talk, first of all, about the World Social Forum. You know, what is it? How long has it been going on? What takes place there? Because, you know, I don't think many people in the United States have much familiarity with it. I think it is an institution that doesn't get a great deal of coverage here.
Yeah.
So why don't you just give a little background on it, if you would?
Yeah, you know, it's easy to complain about press coverage, but in this case, it's a real no-brainer. This thing just doesn't get covered virtually at all by the American press. As you know, Bob, for the last three decades now, the kind of corporate elite of the world have a yearly meeting in Davos, Switzerland, that in recent times has gained higher profile, and that's called the World Economic Forum. And 3 years ago, exactly, actually 2 years ago exactly, in 2001, some Latin American and European academics and activists, strategists on the left, got together and said, what we need to do is hold an alternative to the World Economic Forum. And they came up with the idea of the World Social Forum, which was to be kind of an anti-Davos. It was to be a gathering of the social movements and political movements of the world as opposed to the economic elite. And for many reasons, they chose Porto Alegre, Brazil, to do this. One of the reasons they did it is that Porto Alegre, which is a city of about 1.5 million in the southern part of Brazil, has been governed for the last 14 or 15 years by the Workers' Party, which is the left-of-center party of the newly elected Brazilian president Lula. And in its first year, in 2001, the forum drew about 15,000 people. Last year I went to it, it drew about 50,000 people. And this year it drew about 100,000 people. And in a nutshell, it is literally a week-long kaleidoscope of 1,750 conferences, panel discussions, workshops, lectures, and seminars held in four major venues throughout the city. So it's really kind of an extraordinary annual gathering.
And what sort of stuff is talked about in this kaleidoscope to give our listeners, a sense of what's going on there?
Well, the shorthand for this over the last couple of years is that this is the World Summit of the Anti-Globalization Movement. Now, of course, most people in that movement don't like to be called anti-globalization, and I think the preferred term nowadays is global justice. So, in short, it is a multifaceted look. With 1,700 panels, you better bet it's multifaceted. It's a multifaceted look at globalization and its effects, certainly from a perspective that is at least critical of the corporate agenda.
And were there a lot of Americans there?
Well, the first year they were barely present. Last year there were about 400. This year there was about 1,800. So it was one of the larger delegations there. And that number was ramped up a great degree by the anti-war activity, because what we saw at this year's World Social Forum was a much bigger overlap between if not a melding, if you will, of the peace movement and the global justice people.
So the war discussion of the prospective U.S. War in Iraq was a major theme at the conference this year?
A major theme, and almost, I would say, I'm one of those people who oppose the war as proposed by President Bush. But that said, it was a major theme, I would say, almost to the point of distraction. I don't think it quite got there, but it certainly threatens to get there. But, that's a function of war itself, right? I mean, war kind of, by definition, sucks up all the oxygen in the room, and it's hard to do anything else, either to fight a war or to oppose a war. So the war was certainly front and center. And I just want to add in the description of this conference, this conference brings together this World Social Forum brings together what you might call the A-list of international leftists. I mean, it's everybody from, Noam Chomsky to Arundhati Roy to, our friends like Barbara Ehrenreich and of course, thousands of other very important activists whose names are not household names.
We're talking to Mark Cooper today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Mark's joining us from his home in Los Angeles. Mark's the contributing editor for The Nation, an expert on Latin American politics, and a journalist who's written for a wide number of media over the past 30 years. Mark is also the host of The Nation's syndicated weekly show, Radio Nation, which I believe is carried on WILL.
Yeah.
And Mark, if people would like to call in and talk to Mark, the number here is 333-9455, and our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. One of the big stories in Latin America, and I assume it was a huge story at the World Social Forum, was that there's been quite a lot of political change in Latin America in the past two or three years. I mean, the whole continent has really been turned upside down in many respects. And not the least of which is Brazil. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Not the least of which, of course, is the host country for this, which is Brazil, and the election last fall and the inauguration this January of President Luis Ignacio da Silva, known universally as Lula, who was, I don't know how deep you want to get into that, but Lula was a...
Go right ahead.
Lula's rather extraordinary case. He's... a very poor rural child who dropped out of school when he was 12, literally worked as a boot black, never went back to school, became a metal worker at the time of the Brazilian military dictatorship, was instrumental, if not the key element, in rebuilding Brazil's militant labor unions. If that wasn't enough, 20 years ago he began building the Workers' Party, which is kind of a sui generis left-of-center party, neither Marxist-Leninist nor social democratic, I would say, in Brazil, and won the election finally after three failed attempts. He won in October with 61% of the vote, was inaugurated in January, and really has become the great hope for some alternative to, you know, what in technical terms is called neoliberalism and what in more common terms is called kind of the radical free market economic recipes that have dominated Latin America over the last couple of decades. So Lula was a towering figure over this World Social Forum, and of course what's going on in Brazil today with Lula was a dominant theme.
Lula spoke at the World Social Forum this year, didn't he?
Yeah, he spoke, and in fact, if you'll allow me to plug one thing, I've got a series of postings on the World Social Forum on the Nation magazine's website that can be seen at thenation.com. That's one word, thenation.com, where I describe some of this in detail, and I have an article that I'm just finishing that'll appear in the print version of the magazine in the next couple of weeks. But yes, Lula spoke, and it was an extraordinary speech. I was there. There were about 70 or 100,000 people to hear him speak outside. It was his speaking manner is unlike any politician that I've seen. It's just simple. I don't want to romanticize it or patronize him, but it is literally like a guy off a factory floor talking to you. There's none of the posed theatrics or overheated rhetoric that you get from politicians of any stripe. And what was extraordinary about this year was that Lula spoke to the crowd at the World Social Forum with a strong message of social justice and equality, and then announced that as soon as he was finished, he was going to get on a plane and fly to Davos, Switzerland, to bring that same message right into the heart of the corporate elite, which he did 48 hours later, and quite effectively. So there were some pretty emotional highs to this whole scene the last week.
We're talking to Mark Cooper today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller. Let's go to the phone lines now. Champaign County, you're on the air with Mark Cooper.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon. I'm wanting to, I guess it's morning out there, sorry about the bad weather. I'm wanting to proffer two subjects here, and one of them has to do with media policy in Chile when you were there, and whether your dealings with Armin Matillard and Ariel Dorfman are included in your memoir of that time.
I see.
I don't know. I'm sure that might be a bit of a digression, no, but something more on Chile. But I'm propelled to ask you this. You just came from Brazil, where in some of the states where the PT isn't in power, they have summary execution of undesirables on the street by the police. Mm-hmm. And you're talking to people in a state where even the governor has declared a moratorium and then commuted death sentences. And he in the process made a thoroughgoing challenge of the whole judicial system. It's absolutely astonishing. Maybe he feels a little guilty since he's about to be criminally indicted, but it doesn't take away from some of the analysis he offers, which is that there are snitches, there are deals, there are forced confessions, there are intimidated witnesses. And what I'm getting at, you probably figured out by now, but there's a quote that circulated about that you said that you would like to have a year without Mamiya. Now, I know there's a lot of cause célèbre, and there's a lot of, but if you can't get past that problem and look at the reality of what the death penalty.
Let me answer your question.
Okay, go right ahead.
I'll answer your question. Let me start with the second question. I don't know if you read the entire article that I'm referring to, that you're referring to.
And Mark, for the sake of our listeners, let's give a little background, because I suspect many of them are being thrust into the middle of something they're completely...
I'm about to.
Okay, thanks.
2 or 3 years ago, right around January 1st, talking about New Year's resolutions, I indeed wrote an editorial, which I am proud of and I would write again, that said, please grant me a year without any more discussion of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the reason I wrote that, if you will read the entire piece, is that I argue passionately for an abolitionist position of the death penalty. And I said that the discussion around Mumia seemed sterile to me because it was being framed wrong, whether or not Mumia Abu-Jamal was innocent or guilty. I argued, if you'll allow me the heresy to say that I believe he was guilty, but that it doesn't matter, that I oppose the death penalty for innocent people and guilty people, and that the question of the death penalty is so important in this country. And there are 3,500 people on death row, most of whose names we've never heard of, 1,100 of whom have no legal counsel, that I thought that we had spent enough time already on Mumia Abu-Jamal, made him far too much of a celebrity case, pinned way too much on the tenuous notion that he was innocent, and that we ought to get serious about a real abolitionist campaign that would get rid of the death penalty, period. So I stand by 100% what I wrote, and I'm very glad that Governor Ryan did what he did, more power to that. And in terms of your second, your first question,
could I have a point of reply here?
Sure, go right ahead.
I still assert that by limiting it to just death penalty opposition, which I agree with you in,
you're
not even accepting some of the stuff that even this Republican governor has said, which is there is malfeasance by the police. Now,
I'm very clear. I oppose the death penalty at all levels, under any circumstances, for any reason. Of course I understand. I don't need to be lectured on the malfeasance of the police or the failures of the criminal justice system.
You
I agree
up in your answer.
I agree completely.
Okay, well, the point being, you can set aside his guilt or innocence. I've seen enough to know that he didn't get a fair trial. Well,
and I also said that in my piece.
The judge that was most has put to death
more people
in the country.
I also said that in my piece. I suggest before you debate something I wrote, you actually read it. I also said that Mumia Abu-Jamal got a bum trial and he should get a new trial.
I was responding to what you said in this moment, not as opposed to what you're asserting you said somewhere else. But anyway,
what exactly,
we're beating a dead horse because you and I agree.
I don't think we're beating a dead horse.
Well, Colin, if I can just ask you a second, what did Mark Cooper say that you disagree with? What did he just say that you disagree with?
I don't see why he can't rise above the cause celebre phenomena and say, okay, put aside his guilt or innocence. We need a thoroughgoing review of the...
No, I went...
Mark, let him finish.
Why
I didn't say we needed a review. I said we needed to abolish the death penalty. My review of the death penalty, personally, was completed several decades ago. I'm opposed to it, so I'm way beyond you. I don't want a review. I want it abolished for everybody, including Mumia Abu-Jamal. What I said was that I was disturbed that all of the focus on this was put on Mumia Abu-Jamal's guilt or innocence, rather on the bigger issue of the moral dimension of the death penalty and the legal dimension of the death penalty, which I oppose in absolute terms.
I think you're reducing the argument, and you're reducing your...
All right, fine. Well,
well, I don't think we're going to get...
I can't make it any clearer for you.
Well, let's switch, if we can, to the first question the caller had, Mark, and talk a little bit about Chile. You were there, and once again, I'm not saying... This is something I would only say rarely, because I'm so impressed by the book Pinochet and Me that you wrote that came out 2 years ago. That I'd urge people to read it, because I think you have a feeling for Chilean politics that I've rarely seen by an English language writer. Mm-hmm. And you were there. You were Salvador Allende's translator as a very young man in the early 1970s. What was your experience with Chilean media, and specifically people like Ariel Dorfman? What was their role?
Well, I can say proudly that Ariel Dorfman is a friend of mine, but after the fact, I didn't know Ariel in Chile. He was in a different social or political circle than I was. I was aware of his work because one of the first books I read when I got to Chile was indeed Dorfman and Mattelhart's now classic book, How to Read Donald Duck, which was a rather brilliant ideological deconstruction of the Donald Duck comics and American comics as they played out in Chile. So in the subsequent years since then, Ariel has become a friend of mine. In fact, he's written endorsement or one of the blurbs on the book that you mentioned of mine. That said, you know, the Chilean media was extraordinary because the entire Chilean experience was extraordinary. It was one of the broadest range of media that I've ever seen in my life. There were, I can't remember the exact number anymore, but there were roughly 11 or 12 daily newspapers, you know, from the hard right to the hard left and all kinds of things in between.
This was in Santiago?
This was in Santiago, yeah, and in other parts. That's right, in terms of national newspapers. The radio stations ran the same spectrum, and even the television stations did. Certainly the privately held and thereby more conservative media dominated and had a bigger chunk of the pie than the left, but the left had a significant portion, and it was quite a privilege and a formative experience to live in a place, at least for a couple of years, where you had that sort of breadth of public debate, something that, as you know, Bob, in your writing and research is somewhat absent here.
You know, one of the things that's striking when I read about Chile, not just in the Allende period, but even in the years leading up to that, but prior to the 1973 coup d'etat and overthrow of the Allende government, was the degree of sort of political enthusiasm, interest, knowledge, awareness across the population, not just among academics or professional punsters.
Right.
Was really rather, I mean, by American standards, almost unbelievable. I mean, it's just quite amazing.
Yeah, well, I just saw something quite similar in Brazil, as a matter of fact, this last week, that felt a lot like that period during Allende. And I guess that responds to two things. I think in kind of the superficial level, it responds to the heat of the moment, and it responds to those moments when, you know, a critical mass of citizens feels that there's something really at stake or something really happening in their political process. But as you also know, Bob, reality is the greatest incubator of ideology. Mm-hmm. And one's real ideology comes from one's real experience. And the fact is that in a place like Chile or a place like in 1970 or a place like Brazil in the year 2003, for most people, what is at stake is much more immediate and much more palpable than what is at stake in some of the movements we have in the United States. That's a function of wealth, I think. I don't think that there's any deep, dark mystery about that. You know, many of the issues that activists in this country frame, they frame in moral terms, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that can be quite noble. But in places like Chile and Brazil, certainly there's a moral dimension to politics, but there's also an immediate reality of food, shelter, clothing, and education. And that tends to motivate people, for better or for worse, a lot more. Well, it tends to incite them a lot more immediately than broad moral or philosophical questions.
We're talking to Mark Cooper today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have some phone lines open. The number is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Urbana, you're on the air with Mark Cooper.
Yeah, I'd like to hear what you might have to say about Venezuela. That was... Mm-hmm. Certainly, this is a media program, and that was certainly one of the greatest examples of free enterprise as boiler and propaganda mill. And also, before you get up, I hope you can talk at least a little bit, if there's anything to talk about, that is, about what's being looked at as the great hope for the future out of this forum. Has anything come out that, you know, is is likely to make people feel a little bit more optimistic. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you, caller.
Well, the situation in Venezuela was also palpable this week in the World Social Forum because the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, made a kind of a surprise visit to the World Social Forum. He was not allowed to participate directly because heads of state are not allowed to participate in what is called a people's forum. He did, however, hold some parallel events and tried to take advantage of the press that was there. I have a rather heretical position on Hugo Chavez when it comes to what most of the American left thinks. I believe that, to be cute about it for a minute, I think that Hugo Chavez's opposition looks very much like Allende's, but he doesn't look at all like Allende. So I think that what we've seen in Venezuela is a slow-motion 20-year collapse of the political class. It really is a kleptomaniacal elite in Venezuela, very, very removed from the lives and interests of ordinary people, and had proceeded over two or three of the past decades to literally sack the petro wealth of Venezuela and make sure that none of it get down to ordinary people, while at the same time this political class immersed itself in rather grotesque corruption, discrediting itself completely and paving the way for somebody like Hugo Chavez. And I am prepared to argue with anybody who wants to argue it that Hugo Chavez is not very much of a revolutionary or radical. I think he's mostly a demagogue and one that is not particularly democratic. But he's a product. He's a product of the collapse of the Venezuelan political system. So both sides kind of got what they deserved in a sense. Unfortunately, the Venezuelan people are caught in the middle of this right now, and I don't foresee a happy ending. That said, of course, the private Venezuelan media is playing a really radical role in trying to get rid of Chavez. I don't think the answer lies in shutting down the media. I think the answer lies in providing a politics that is better than theirs, period. In terms of what comes out of the World Social Forum, that is optimistic or promising, because of the nature of the World Social Forum, it doesn't emit declarations or pass resolutions or offer blueprints. It's a gathering point for many, many different movements from all over the world, and all of them at different states of development with different perspectives, etc. I think that the most hopeful signs that came out of Porto Alegre this year was the tremendous optimism that is being generated by Lula, by the Brazilian government's new approach to trade issues, by its willingness to take on the United States in terms of trade equity and in regional equity, trying to become a leader for South America, to not just buckle to the free trade area of the Americas that the Bush administration is proposing. And I think there was a lot of there was a certain amount of optimism that was generated by the pessimism of Davos, the fact that the Davos gathering this year had to take as its theme the question of legitimacy. That was literally its theme in the wake of all these corporate meltdowns and of the sluggish world markets.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of joy taken by people in Porto Alegre that the Davos people felt themselves in a jam.
Mark, if we could go back to Venezuela for a second, because I don't know how closely our listeners have been following the story. Unless one is really zeroing in on learning about Venezuela, it's not one that's going to jump out at you in our news media or news media coverage. Mm-hmm. And one other thing that Chavez shares with Allende, as I see it, is that he was elected in a fair election. And he has the constitutionally in a democratic state in power and is not threatened to overthrow that constitution or remove it. Yet in our press coverage, it seems that the democratic nature of his election, whatever one might think of Chavez,
right,
plays a much smaller role than it might were Chavez a friend of the United States and the opponents of Chavez enemies of interests of the United States?
There's no question about that. And, of course, we saw that last April in the kind of two-day failed coup that first ousted Chavez from power, and then he returned, 36 hours later, carried by a reaction from, a big part of the Venezuelan population. There's no question, Bob, that there is that bias and that it is often overlooked that Chavez was elected democratically. That said, the left has to be careful because our enemy's enemy is not necessarily our friend. And those people who raise questions about Chavez's democratic credentials are not necessarily crazy. Don't forget that Chavez attempted his own military coup, disrespecting the constitution then in force 10 years ago in Venezuela, and that some of the alterations that he's made to the Venezuelan political system and to the rewriting of the constitution in Venezuela, I think have been less than pristine, to be diplomatic. So it's one of those situations where you try as hard as you can and you find lots of bad guys and not a lot of good guys.
All right. We're talking to Mark Cooper today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple lines open. The local number, 333-9455. Toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have a caller from Eureka. You're on the air with Mark Cooper.
Thank you. You mentioned, and I believe the email that your program sends out described your guest as having worked with Salvador Allende. I wonder if you could just help maybe refresh the events which led up to his overthrow. My memory is that the CIA had invested something like $1 million given to the opposition political parties. Is that accurate? And what other things could you add that the United States did in meddling and maybe helping to aid his overthrow?
Well, the United States gave a lot more than $1 million. It's still 30 years after the fact. It's hard to get a hard number, but I think it's more like 30 to 40 million was invested, maybe more. When Salvador Allende was elected in September of 1970, there was a two-month period between the time of his election and the time of his inauguration. We now have ample documentation of everything from the Church Commission to the latest batches of Freedom of Information releases of U.S. government documents that a concerted campaign was run out of the Nixon White House with Henry Kissinger as the generalissimo of that campaign. And I would refer you to my friend Christopher Hitchens' book, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, for the fullest documentation of that chapter, where the White House literally wound up supporting a program that kidnapped and assassinated the Chilean commander-in-chief of the armed forces, hoping that would provoke a military coup and prevent Salvador Allende from taking power. That did occur. The commander, René Schneider, was indeed assassinated, and there was, however, no military coup. That, in fact, backfired on the U.S., and it built support for Allende, and Allende was duly inaugurated on schedule in November of 1970. Over the course of the 3 years that he governed, a large opposition movement fueled by the political right and by the economic right did indeed arise, and I think that opposition movement would have arisen under any circumstances. It's only natural. The Central Intelligence Agency and the Nixon administration continued to play a role in supporting that opposition in a number of covert ways, and certainly helped grease the skids necessary for the military coup that eventually took place in September 1973. And of course, at that, from that point forward, at least for the first handful of years, the United States was an ardent supporter of the Pinochet military dictatorship. The ironic history is that the Pinochet dictatorship then proceeded to carry out all of the barbarous crimes that the administration claimed that Allende had engaged in, when Allende was in fact quite a pure Democrat, and there was none of that funny business going on. But then, of course, we tolerated, the U.S. tolerated, of what was, it encouraged, what turned out to be one of the bloodiest dictatorships in the history of the hemisphere.
Mark, we had someone who called in but didn't want to go on air, but they left their question for you that I'd like to ask you now. Someone called in and asked if you could comment on Lula apparently made a proposal to create a Latin American petroleum exporting countries group similar or vis-a-vis OPEC or similar to OPEC. On the fact that the oil-producing nations in South America now are under the control of or under the leadership of progressive or left-wing leaders.
Actually, the caller got it wrong. That was a proposal that was made by Hugo Chavez.
Okay.
While we were there, and it was kind of an off-the-cuff proposal and not a very well-thought-out one, because there are many oil-producing countries in Latin America, but there's only one that's an exporter, and that's Venezuela. And Venezuela is a member of OPEC. So it actually would have very little sense, because Brazil still imports oil, Peru supports oil, Ecuador imports oil. So it's an idea that would not have any effective clout.
Let's turn to another country in Latin America now, if we can, Mark, and talk about Colombia.
Yeah.
This is a country that has, I think, set every continental record now for human rights abuses.
Yes.
And I think similar to Venezuela, but in a much more dramatic manner, sort of like the good guy crowd is sometimes hard to locate.
Very small.
But at the same time, the war crime crowd or the bad guy crowd is real easy to locate.
Yeah.
And the United States has, since 9/11, increasingly made support for the Colombian military part of its war on terrorism. Could you talk a little bit about what's going on in Colombia now?
Yeah, okay. In 30 seconds.
Well, actually, take as long as you'd like, because I think it's an issue, once again, that in our news media.
Well, Colombia is a country that for the last, depending where you want to start the clock, you could say for the last 50 years, the last 40 years, has been the stage for ongoing political bloodletting of colossal proportions. In fact, the Colombians have a rather sardonic name for the people who carry out the bloodletting. They're called the Armed Actors. And they call them the Armed Actors because there's so many of them. There's the military, there's the armed forces of Colombia, the military and police that has a dismal human rights record, probably the worst in Latin America as we speak. There is 10 or 12,000 member paramilitary groups on the extreme right, some of them allied with some portions of the Colombian military, at least if not formally, effectively so, that are quite expert in bloodletting. And then we have about 20 to 25,000 guerrillas of two major organizations, the FARC and the ELN, which are not your father's guerrillas, to catch a term from Pontiac. These are, you know, put aside your Che Guevara romanticism for a minute. You're dealing with some very hardcore folks who have used some pretty brutal methods themselves. The ELN guerrillas, for example, are masters in kidnapping and ransoming, often of ordinary people. Or even poor people in Brazil. And all of these armed factions, from the military to the paramilitary to the left guerrillas, are to some degree or another involved in the nation's cocaine trafficking, drug trafficking. Different levels, you can split hairs different ways you want, but at the end of the day, all of them make hundreds of millions of dollars off the cocaine trade. And they're all involved in it. And the United States took advantage last decade of a rather ambitious reform plan put forth by the then president of Venezuela, Andrés Pastrana, who, with many flaws, at least had come up with a notion of a multi-billion dollar social, economic, and military program to try and bring reform and pacification to Brazil. By the time Pastrana's idea went through the State Department mill, it came out in a different form. It came out basically as a military program with the social and economic portion sheared off. So what we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years is about $2 billion, that's 2B with a, as in baby, billion, U.S. dollars, invested in military hardware, military training, Black Hawk helicopters, special forces advisors, etc., by the United States, given to the Colombian government basically to intensify the war. And it's a war that nobody has won in the last 50 years, and it's kind of hard to imagine that anybody's going to win it now. So what we see is indeed just more bloodletting, and not surprisingly, as we saw in El Salvador, which was a similar situation 20 years ago, you know, the polarization in the of the situation and the intensification of the war, as promoted by the United States in the last few years, has now led to the election of a very right-wing and bellicose Colombian president, Mr. Uribe, who makes any settlement of this thing seem even more remote. So it's a very, very, very grim situation.
And we should add that Colombia is a large, it's unlike El Salvador, which is a nation, I think, of 5 or 6 million
right.
people. Colombia is, what, 40 million people?
30 or 40 million.
It's a significant population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's go back to Lula and some of the comments and the comparison you raised between Brazil and Chile, just about the enthusiasm of the population and the involvement in political affairs. You know, you also described the opposition of the United States to Allende from the get-go and how they really supported and at times orchestrated and subsidized campaigns to eliminate him and his popular unity government.
Right.
Lula is not the president of a nation of 10 or 12 million people in the corner of South America, but the president of a nation of 175-some million people,
right.
One of the largest nations in the world and most important. What is your sense of the relationship of the U.S. government to Lula? What should we anticipate? What can Americans do about it?
That's a really good question, and it defies simple answers, Bob. These are different times and a different country. Remember that Chile also took place in the context of the Cold War, where that kind of Cold War thinking really was at a feverish level. In the White House of Nixon. Don't forget that was still the period the war in Vietnam was still raging. Cuba was still a hot revolution. Armed revolution seemed quite plausible in other parts of Latin America at that point. So there was a whole geopolitical Cold War aspect to the U.S. Campaign against Allende. A lot of that has dissipated, of course, in the last 30 years. And as you point out, Brazil occupies a very different space in the U.S. Sphere. There is huge American and European investment in Brazil. The stability of the Brazilian economy is important to the United States and to the international financial institutions. Quite frankly, Chile was small potatoes, and the IMF, the World Bank, the Nixon administration couldn't give a whit if Chile was pushed into the sea. Brazil is quite different. If the Brazilian economy collapses, probably the entire continent's economy collapses and then has shockwaves into the United States and into Western Europe. So I think that the U.S. position toward Lula is circumspect but not aggressive. I think that there is enough maturity in the State Department now, independent of who's president. I'm talking about the professionals part of the U.S. diplomatic machinery that understands a little bit better that when you have somebody like Lula who wins 61% of the vote, you know, the smartest thing to do is not to run a bunch of black covert programs to try and pull the plug on him. And in any case, Lula is constrained from the U.S. point of view, is constrained by the global markets. and by the agreement that Brazil has signed with the International Monetary Fund for a structural adjustment program that Lula has said he will comply with, and that most of his Workers' Party believes that Brazil has to comply with, not because it's morally good or because it's what they want. It's because Brazil is in a dependent situation in the global economy and has little choice other than to conform to some degree and work within whatever margins are possible to try and elaborate some alternatives. So
yeah.
There's a very cool, calculated pragmatism, I think, on at least on the Brazilian side, and a certain reservedness on the U.S. side.
That calls to mind, though, as you raise that very important point, and I think you're absolutely right from everything I've read, the experience in South Africa in the past decade, which elected a government, I think, with similar popular aspirations and support, and made its accommodation with the global financial community because it had to do so in order to have a viable economy.
Yeah.
And has really sort of had significant problems because it's been very difficult to deliver the goods to the general population.
Well, look, I think you're absolutely correct. And I think these are hard truths for at least American leftists to understand or to sympathize with, because the instinct is, oh, well, you know, Mandela, or in this case, Lula, or, Thabo Mbeki, these guys have just sold out to international capital. Well, that's one possible facile interpretation, but to be very orthodox about it, as you know from your earlier studies, Bob, if you go back to those who really conceived of alternatives to capitalism, like Karl Marx, these folks were very clear, even 150 years ago, that we were dealing with a global economy and that there could be no socialism in one country, and there wasn't certainly going to be socialism in one poor country. That when you talk about alternatives to capitalism, you de facto have to talk about the centers of economic power like the United States and Europe. And as long as those countries remain the mainstays of a global economic capitalist system, those countries in the periphery, especially even powerful ones like Brazil, are restricted to what they can do. I mean, this is open discussion in Brazil because there's an extreme left in Brazil that is already saying that Lula is sold out and that he should go tell the IMF to take a hike and he should cancel the foreign debt. And all that's very nice on paper, but it begs the question of how you feed people the day after the IMF credits are cut off.
In one country that's addressing this very similar problem is to the south of Brazil, Argentina, the country that was the poster child of these free market reforms in the 1990s, which has, as has been written about and spoken about, really fallen on extraordinarily difficult times economically in the past few years.
Yes.
And is trying to wrestle with this very issue.
That's right. These are not easy issues to come up with. You know, there was a symbolic moment, if you'll allow me here in the last minute or two. Last week when I was in Brazil, I went to a press conference offered by the president of the Workers' Party, José Jonino, quite a distinguished and respected and admired activist of the last number of decades, a guy who's really earned his bones. And we were in a small room, about 30 or 40 people, and, you know, I had just asked him a question about what Brazil's position was going to be on the free trade area of the Americas, and he was giving a properly nuanced answer, which was neither yes nor no. It depends on what kind of terms we can get. And in the middle of his answer, some young woman got up and threw a cream pie in his face and threw a bunch of leaflets in the air saying that, you know, Lula doesn't represent the people of Brazil when he goes to talk to the bankers in Davos. And it was signed by a group called Bakers Without Borders. A friend of mine and I joked that it sounded more like Bakers Without Brains. But that symbol, that small act, symbolizes to me some of the irrationality around what is sometimes people's wish lists. Wish lists are fine, but you have to make sure that, you know, when you're dealing with somebody like Lula, who's governing a country of 175 million people, where 50 million of them don't eat properly, you have to think 2, 3, 4, 5 times before you make a dramatic gesture and you tell the international financial community to get off at the next stop. It's just not that easy in the real world.
We've been listening this hour to Mark Cooper, the contributing editor for The Nation magazine. He's been talking to us about Latin American politics. I hear the band tuning up in the background, Mark, which means I've got to clear out of here.
All right.
You know, I really want to thank you for being our guest. It's been very enlightening and informative for us in Latin America. I hope we can get you back on the air and sometime down the road.
No problem, Bob. Been a pleasure.
All right. And I'm Bob McChesney, your host of Media Matters. We're going to be back 1 week from today with Eric Alderman talking about his new book, What Liberal Media? I'd like to thank Ben Scott for being our wonderful producer, as always. And have a good week. Bye-bye.